Good afternoon, everyone, and a very warm welcome to Scottish Future Forum seminar on artificial intelligence and its increasing role in our lives. My name is Claire Adamson. I'm the MSP for Motherwell and Wishaw, and I convene the Parliament's cross-party group on science and technology. And I do dream of electric sheep, so I'm absolutely delighted to be hosting today. This is a joint venture on behalf of the Parliament's Future Forum. One of the jobs of the Future Forum is to help us to take a step back and discuss how life in Scotland is changing now and could change in the future. I'm therefore delighted to welcome one of the UK's leading science writers, Tom Chivers, to discuss artificial intelligence, the marriage of new technology and computer learning, which is transforming the world we live in. Tom will discuss how AI is developing and how we should react both as citizens and as a legislature. Tom is here in conjunction with Reform Scotland, a public policy think tank, who are partners for this event, and I'm delighted to welcome its director, Chris Deeran, who is now going to say a few words of introduction.
A very few words, really just to make the point that I'm here. One of the things we're trying to do at Reform Scotland is to look forward to the big challenges that we're all facing. So while we are focused very much on Scottish education and the Scottish economy and whatever, we also want to look out at the big global challenges that face not just Scotland, but humanity as a whole. And I think sometimes in Scotland, as we talk about the Westminster bubble, there's a bit of an Edinburgh bubble, and we all talk to each other and we all get caught in our own little sort of circular conversation. So one of the things we're trying to do with our events is to bring people from out with that bubble who are thinking hard on a kind of global level about the big challenges that we face. And I think as Scots, just having that sense of let's think about this within Scotland, but also gazing outward, taking account of all the best that's being thought out there, and not just get caught in our own little arguments and political feuds and that kind of thing. So we're doing an event tonight where Tom's speaking, and also Jamie Suskind, who wrote a book called Future Politics, which has sold well and been very well received, and Kate Forbes as well. So we've done a few of these types of things, different subjects, but always with the intention of bringing people in from outside, so that in a way we get to raise our game, raise our sight above the horizon a little bit, and learn from people who've been out in the world, taking it on its own terms and not just as a sort of bunch of Scottish people nattering at each other or shouting at each other. So anyway, that's all I have to say, and I'll pass back. Thank you.
Thank you. So could I introduce Tom? He's a science writer based in London. He was science writer for BuzzFeed UK for 3 years to 2018, and has since written, among others, The Times, The Guardian, The New Scientist, The Telegraph and Unheard. He has received several awards for his journalism, including in the Explaining the Facts category from the Royal Statistical Society. Most importantly for today, he's the author of recently released The AI Does Not Hate You, Superintelligence, Rationality and the Race to Save the World, in which he examines AI risk and what the future holds for the human race. In short, he's the perfect person to talk to us on the subject of artificial intelligence.
Great. Thank you. I hope I am. I doubt I'm perfect. Let's give it a try. So I thought I'd start by just talking a bit about what we mean when we say AI, because it's the word intelligence gets people sort of, sends people down these sort of philosophical routes about, you know, what is something, whether it's something truly intelligent, what is really artificial intelligence in it. And I think you can sidestep a lot of that. You get into this blurry line, you know, is it AI or is it just doing statistics, or is it AI or is it just software, or is it AI or is it technology? And I think a lot of this ends up in sort of philosophical debate that you can sidestep quite easily. The only question is whether that's important is whether it's a machine that is capable of doing something that previously only humans could do. So often people prefer to avoid the whole term artificial intelligence and talk in terms of, say, machine learning or just technology or automation, and then we can avoid that whole what is intelligence really, because to a large degree we don't care unless we're philosophers, which admittedly I was for a long time, but you know, we don't care what intelligence truly is. We don't really care if computers know what love is, or you know, if they have emotions and all this sort of stuff. We just want to know whether it is competent, whether it is, you know, powerful, whether it's doing the things we want it to do, or whether it's doing other things. And AI has, over the last few years, really dramatically become much more competent. It's able to do many, many more human jobs. I mean, it's been, for a long time, sort of simple, repetitive human jobs have been steadily replaced, you know, way back to the 17th, 18th century, with things like the spinning jenny. You know, jobs have been steadily replaced by artificial technologies. But now, you know, increasingly more what we would have thought of as creative or sort of really human jobs are going. And from my own personal point of view, for instance, it's mildly unnerving that some forms of journalism can be now automated. You know, you can get some of the sort of simpler financial stories of like this particular stock has risen, this one has fallen, can now be written by an algorithm, and they do just the job, you know, with no style or a land, but they are, it is done. You know, the job is effectively done. And increasingly, the things that they can do are stray into stuff that we would consider creative. I mean, it was earlier this year, or possibly late, I think it was earlier this year, that the OpenAI released something called GPT-2, which you could give like a line of a prompt. They gave it a line of Tolkien at some Tolkien thing at the beginning, and it churned out 1,000 words of, I mean, bad Tolkien fan fiction, which was, you know, I've read worse Tolkien fan fiction by humans, definitely. And then the other day, it was only a few days ago, that there was, I think it might have been Microsoft, but they managed to build an AI which could pass an eighth grade science test, which, you know, in a US eighth grade science test, which was a long standing, you know, this involves putting together logical concepts, understanding natural language, all these things. These are things that are, you know, the really sort of push at the idea of this of what it means to be intelligent. This is, you know, it's quite hard to sort of say, all the time we're saying, AI can do this, but it can't do this. This is the thing that makes us human. Increasingly, all these bits are sort of being eaten away at. It can do more and more of these things. A thing about the way that they are made, especially most modern AIs run on this idea of neural network, which is they learn by the nodes within them. I won't go into the details of it, but these sort of nodes within them get different weights depending on the data that comes in. So they train on data. Essentially, how you can think of it is you get vast amounts of data, you put it into a black box, it sloshes around a bit, and then it comes out the other end and it gives you your outcomes, and you see how the outcomes do. Like, so whether it's good at translating the text you give it, or whether it's good at writing your Tolkien fanfic or anything like that. And it obviously, if the results look really good, that's great, but you don't know how it's getting to those results. So the risk is often that if it's going to go wrong in some weird way, then you won't know because you don't know what's going on the inside of it. And also, you won't know if your data set, I mean, this has happened several times, but if you don't know if your data set turns out to be biased in some unpredictable way, for example, it is the Amazon hiring algorithm last year, which they realized they had to sort of shut down after a while because they realized that all the hiring data they'd trained on had been skewed towards hiring white men, you know. AI can only be, is always a bit of a black box, and is only ever as good as its the data it's trained on. I figured probably some of the key things that you guys would be interested in from sort of from a governing point of view would be the impact on things like jobs and automation. And the history, you know, as we were talking about a minute ago, the history of this goes back 300 years or so. We're talking about machines replacing humans in jobs going all the way back to the Industrial Revolution. And the history has generally been short-term disruption, so people really do lose their jobs in the short term, but that the new jobs are created. You know, it's not that we're all just now failed weavers. There is new jobs have since been made. And increasingly, it allows you to augment jobs rather than replace them. So an example that has come up again and again when I've been speaking to people is that of radiologists. A lot of a radiologist's job is boringly going through scans and seeing, does this look like it is cancerous? Does this look like it? You know, and then, so what they can now increasingly AIs are capable of doing that bit for them. So that the radiologist can spend less time boringly going through scans and more time doing the things that humans are good at, which is spending time with other humans. It also increases the accuracy. So if a radiologist looking at scans is 90% accurate at judging whether a scan shows a cancer, and an AI gets about 90% right as well, because they make different mistakes. They will, if you get an AI and a radiologist look at it, you end up at about 99% accuracy. So the two can work hand in hand rather than we've suddenly got AIs coming in. We don't need radiologists anymore. You can use them to improve the jobs that they do. You can use them to free up time that that humans can do the things that humans are more skilled at. And it lets you do things you couldn't do in the past. So I've been talking to a lot of people about the use of AI in scientific research. And for example, some things when you're looking at enormous data sets like genome-wide association studies, where there are millions and millions of data, far more, you know, sometimes more, you know, millions and millions of data sets, which you then have to look at cross-section with itself in millions and millions of ways, cross-reference, I should say. You end up with these vast data sets that have, you know, more combinations than there are atoms in the universe, and it would be simply impossible for even the most powerful computer to look through them all these possibilities. And you get AI rather like chess AIs that would just sort of prune down all the possibilities and say, this stuff isn't helpful, we don't need to look at that, we can look at these sort of various possibilities. And so these things allow people to look at vast new data sets which would previously have been just impossible to do. So the ways that these things are doing, they can improve the things you're doing, they can make you able to do new things, and they can free up humans to do things they couldn't previously do. The question that some people have, because generally speaking, there has been this long-term tendency for new technologies to come in, disrupt the economy, put some people out of work, which is really hard, and but then be able to build new economic structures around it. But so it's been rather like the spinning Jenny. There is a concern that AI will be different because it is, unlike the spinning Jenny, it is not replacing a single thing. AI has the ability, if it is intelligent, to do absolutely everything that humans can do. And some people think that the spinning Jenny is the wrong analogy, that it won't be like that. It'll be more like when, you know, in the early 1900s, the horse was the most important transport technology, and it was everywhere. And then suddenly the automobile was replaced, and New York City went from having tens of millions of horses to having a few, like, working in novelty farms and things. So there is a possibility that it will. There is a fear, which I think is probably overstated, but there is a fear in which we don't know how to avoid, that it will end up actually replacing human work, and then that will present a serious challenge to policymakers as more and more people find themselves sort of moved out of the job market. I think it is worth considering that. I worry that it's overstated as a hype, but it is possibly a real risk. And even if it is overstated as a real risk, things like the spinning Jenny and all technology throughout history have put real people really out of work for some time. And even if they later, you know, 30 years later can have, or 10 years later have retrained and got new work, or their children have got new work, it still means many years of economic hardship for real people. And that is something we can seriously expect. And that was technology that moved a lot slower than AI is moving now. So things will be changing much faster. Away from jobs and automation, I thought, well, as politicians, you'd probably be interested in things like trust in politics. There's been a lot of talk about deepfake videos lately, which are almost photorealistic videos, which are very, very hard to detect even by other AIs and they can make people look like they are saying or doing things they absolutely didn't. There was that marvelous one about Barack Obama calling President Trump an absolute dipshit or something like that, if you'll forgive my language. And there was Mark Zuckerberg saying, I've got everyone's data and I'm going to, you know, do what I want with it and all this sort of stuff. They can make people say anything they want. There's also the GPT-2 thing we were talking about bots that can create realistic text. Again, this could be really worrying if you're worrying about sort of Twitter bots out there spreading misinformation or think of people on Facebook. And these are really things worth worrying about. But there's a flip side of it, which is it's not just the faking that's the problem, it's the ability to say that things have been faked. If President Trump were to be caught on video saying things about grabbing women again, that was in 2016, before the real rise of the deepfake video before we all became aware of it. If he was to say that now, it'd be much more plausible for him to say, it's just, this is deepfaked, I didn't say that, it'd be nothing. You know, it would be, you have these, it provides people who are caught in awful situations like that to have plausible deniability. And there's a serious concern that it will reduce overall trust in the system. There's also issues of privacy and data. And this is really one sort of key issue, which is, on the one hand, openness and the use of data is fantastic and brilliant. And like the more we have things like NHS data made available to AI firms like DeepMind, or indeed just generally made available to researchers to use it, this amazing data set, which can let you do wonderful research. I mean, I was speaking to some people who are trying to use brain scans to predict the spread of it, to predict the growth of Alzheimer's. So, you know, so if someone has these features in their brain scan at age 50, how likely are they to have Alzheimer's by age 70? But the trouble is that AI works on huge amounts of data, like all of the amazing facial recognition things and all these translation software. They work by having trillions or billions and billions of data points. And so, you know, in a sense, AI learns very slowly, and it works. We could learn much quicker with that number of data points, but they learn on billions. But when you're dealing with things like scans, you're lucky if you have more than a few hundred or a few thousand. And so making these scans more available to researchers would have huge benefits, because that would mean we'd be able to do much more efficient scientific research, much more effective scientific research. But the more you open it up, the more you open things like this up, the more likely, you know, the more likely it is that the data will get leaked. A lot of it is theoretically anonymized, but can be de-anonymized fairly easily with a few simple, you know, if there's a 65-year-old guy referred from a particular GP to a particular hospital for a particular condition, even if it's not got the name on it, or the date of birth, you can very possibly reverse engineer that and work out sort of to limit it, get it to a few particular individuals. So, and then there's this risk that it'll end up in the hands of people who will use it for purposes we don't want, like insurance companies upping premiums and that sort of stuff. So these are real concerns, and it is a genuine, and as far as I can see, sort of unavoidable trade-off between these advantages that sharing data brings and the risks that it has. That's going to be a decision that has to be sort of faced up to. There will be losses, there'll be problems whichever way we go. I put a little thing here saying, what should we do next? And my next bullet point is, honestly, I don't know. but there are a few sort of thoughts, right? So firstly, as we were just talking about, I think we should be really careful and thoughtful about what data sharing is good and important, and when we should and when we shouldn't, and make it clear to people that they can opt out of sharing it, even if that comes at a cost to our, but you know, people should feel like they have ownership over these things and are able to do what they are able to sort of say, like, this is my data, especially in things like NHS and health data. This is mine. I'm aware that it can do good, but I don't want it out there. And that should be absolutely fine. In terms of the impacts on jobs and automation, you know, economic impact on jobs. My own feeling, and maybe this is a political rather than an analytic thing, but I feel like you need to come up with ways of taxing a modern high tech economy, which allows you to redistribute to people who are left behind by it. I leave the specifics of that to you guys, but that strikes me as it's going to be important. There are going to be people severely left behind by all this, and we should be prepared as these sort of technology makes the world richer, to look out for the people who sort of fall through the cracks. And on things like trust in politics and all that sort of stuff, it's going to be really difficult. There's going to be good reasons not to trust the things we see and read. And people aren't very good at working out what's real and what's not, especially and that sounds awful, but it's true that older people are less good at this than young people. This has been shown repeatedly. Young people sort of grown up around it and have worked out ways of trusting things. One AI expert told me once that it's actually very hard to tell the difference online between a Russian bot and a British pensioner. We have to find ways of sort of warning people a lot of stuff can be trusted, but also sort of saying this doesn't mean you shouldn't trust everything. You know, you should. There has to be some way of finding a way through. I realize this is very vague. You should find an answer, speak, and I don't know quite what the answer is. But I think fundamentally things are changing really, really fast, and the nature of government is that it rightly is sort of quite conservative and slow moving and doesn't change as fast. And there's a lot of, you know, it has to deal with a lot of stakeholders and deal with a lot of things. So it may just be really hard for legislation to keep up with things that are changing this fast. So good luck with that, I guess. that's me. Any questions? And on things like trust in politics and all that sort of stuff, it's going to be really difficult. There's going to be good reasons not to trust the things we see and read. And people aren't very good at working out what's real and what's not, especially, and that sounds awful, but it's true that older people are less good at this than young people. This has been shown repeatedly. Young people sort of grown up around it and have worked out ways of trusting things.